Hello, it's Christine. I'm sitting in a room full of men. First of all, the main man is Frank Crossley, who's going to talk to us. And we've got his nephew, Stephen Clayton, and the chairman of the Blind Society in Todmorden, Peter Cockcroft. Because a lot of people want Frank to tell his story. Frank, how will people know you in Todmorden? How will people know who you are?
Well, not very well, because don't forget I've been away 49 years.
49?
I lived in Canada 49
really?
Years. I've been back 11. Yeah.
But you go to the Blind Society,
yes,
don't?
I go to the Blind Society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you go to the drop-in?
Yes,
the drop-in,
that's right.
Things. Yeah. So you might have seen him there. And Frank has got a really, really interesting war history. So what happened when you signed up?
Well, I was 18 and I just simply went to Manchester.
Were you 18?
I was 18 living. I worked in Todmorden.
Yeah.
I left school at 14.
Yeah.
Went working at Dean and Horse till I was 18. And then they were looking for volunteers. Everybody wanted to get in, the young ones. I couldn't wait till I was 18. About 4 days after I was 18, I was on the train to Manchester to sign up. And 2 weeks later, I was down in Portsmouth.
Wow.
In the Marines. That's what young men were like in my days. You couldn't get in fast enough.
But the war had been going on for quite a long time, hadn't it?
Oh yes, that's right. It had been going on. Well, it was 40. I was 18 in 43.
41.
41.
Yeah.
So the war had been on since 39.
Yeah.
But I was only a little boy. Well, I was only a young man.
Yeah, yeah. So you'd been working in Todmorden, just an ordinary job in Todmorden.
Just an ordinary job.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to get out of the job and get into the uniform, like most boys at that time.
I bet you looked very smart. And then you had to take an aptitude test.
Well, that was the idea. The thing is, everybody were going, no matter how much of I don't say a clown you were, they took you, but if you was a little bit smarter, you'd more use to them than somebody that didn't know one end of a good rifle from the other. So we just took a test and I got a good test.
I got a good test.
Well,
your son says that you came top in the test.
Jack remembers all these things.
Well, he's remembered right. So you came up top.
Well, he says these things, and I was picked to be a signalman, which was a qualified position for an 18-year-old in them days. That's what I'm getting.
So
what he's getting at.
So you got some qualifications. So what sort of signals were you using?
Well, we used radio. We used semaphore.
Semaphore?
Sure. You know, like A, B,
I better
C.
Tell our listeners that Frank is here and he's waving his arms and he's spelling it all out for
them. Well, that's how you use flags. You're on board a ship. You had to spell it out with semaphore.
Right,
But I've even forgot the language now. I know where A is, but when you think we're going back all those years, going 70 years, I was sent to signal school.
Right.
I was at the right attitude.
Yeah.
The aptitude.
Yeah.
So I went to signal school and learned to be a signalman.
Right.
Even though I was a rookie signalman, but I got better.
Yeah. Now, George Mitchell tells me that you also qualified for radar.
Well, radar was was involved. We had radar on the those forts in the Thames estuary.
Right.
You know, there were four forts.
Oh, we better explain this. There were four forts.
They sunk them on the
the Thames estuary itself.
On the estuary.
Right.
With big guns on top. They were defending Margate.
Right.
There were four in a square, and I was in one of them.
So you were out at sea, marooned at sea, were you?
We could see Margate, and we used to come out of Margate on the boat. It used to bring us out. We used to go there on the train, and we did, that was our job. You were like a defence of Margate.
Yeah, and didn't you have the complicated job of estimating the range of the guns?
Oh, well, that was it, you see. A radio wasn't much use on these forts because we were so close together. So what they did is, being a spare man, I was easy to do, be what they call the range finder, which were, you would have seen these ATS people working these machines on the guns in other pictures, won't you?
Yes, yeah.
Well, there's one that tells how far the plane is away. Right. And that has to be programmed into the predictor. That's the big square box that the ATS use. But you have to find out the distance, and this machine that I was taught, it only had two handles. It showed you looked in the lens, you could see the plane there, and you had to line it up until it was an upside down one and a down one, and you had to bring this one here till this one matched that. It was its own version upside down, and once it were level, you used to say, read. Then the one in front would give the thing, and they would put it into their machine. They would program their machine.
To what?
And it worked out how far the shell were going to have to go to hit the plane.
Yeah.
And before it exploded. You know, that's how it worked.
It's sort of basic computer work,
yeah,
isn't it?
It was just a way of... they converted it from hand getting the information into the gun.
Yeah.
The gun had to know, the shell had to be known when it blew up to get the plane.
And of course, munitions were short.
But I had such an easy... I was just a nobody. I could learn this job, but they trained me. But I was on the sideline. If a wireless man was needed, I was available.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I used to have cross flags on my arm.
Right.
Which meant I was signal corps in the Marines. I was a signalman, not just a squad, eh?
Yeah.
It was called Tong Fort that I was
Tong Fort.
Yeah, there were four of them. Knock John was the one next to us. I only remember the two of them. One were called Knock John, and one were called Tong Fort. We was on Tong Fort. And the two others were maybe 15, 20 miles away. And you could see them with the binoculars. It was just a way of defending that area. You know, I hadn't thought about the Tong Fort for so many years. Well, I forgot most of it.
No, you haven't, because we're going to come up now to a day which you will never ever forget, and we won't, and that is June the 6th, 1944.
Yes.
That was D-Day, wasn't it?
That was D-Day.
Yeah.
Well, we was...
How did you get across the channel?
Well, after these forts, that job got finished. Let's say somebody else took over, because we were Marines. We weren't trained. They were just using us. Filling a job in, I suppose. But when that was finished, we went back to being our flotilla, 606 flotilla, and we joined up as an attacking crew. I were never in the front line, as you might say. We joined these, they were called amphibious tanks. They were little tanks, that floated on the water.
Whoa.
They were known as that. They weren't as big as these tanks they have now. They were just like a small van that we have here. And they had a gun. And we had the captain, which actually, our captain of our section, I was in his crew. He drove on the left side. I sat next to him with the wireless alongside me. And then the information came in and he could hear it and I could tune him in. And that was my job, talking they just followed instructions, did our... The other part of the attack was there. We were very small, don't get me wrong. I don't think there was above 60 people in our flotilla. And we just went across the, at the back of, we was at the back of the attack on D-Day. I was nowhere near on the front line. We were just hanging on. I think, since I've thought about it, we were really there cleaning up.
Oh.
Let's say straggle things that were going on afterwards. I don't think we hit the beach until quite a few hours after the first ones went in. The wounded Germans were still on the beach. I can only remember one with a bandage round his head. But see, they were lost from they didn't know where they were going. But as I said, I was a nobody as far as the attack went on. He was doing my job, to do.
But your captain, wasn't he in charge of the whole...
He was in charge of six flotilla.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had me as his right-hand man, being a wireless man.
Yeah.
Because I was his listening voice. He got his instructions and then he passed it on to the rest of the tanks.
It must have been horrible going ashore because of all the sick, wounded and dead.
Well, it was, but we was at the back. I'll bet we didn't go in till middle of the morning. I think they went in about early morning, 6 o'clock, the attack was four, let's guess that. And we went in, let's say 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
When there'd been 4 hours of something going on.
Yeah.
The tankers were coming in then, and then they were building that Mulberry.
The Mulberry Harbour.
Yeah, it was, they made a harbour in Arromanches.
We're in Arromanche, which is in...
That was the town we went in at.
With a fabulous beach, wasn't it?
Yeah,
fabulous.
But it was no good for a landing.
No,
it was like a Blackpool beach.
It's a sunbathing beach, is Arromanche, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what they did is they built a kind of a, they said platforms, so that trawlers could pull alongside, like in a proper harbour.
Yeah.
But there were no harbour there, but they made a harbour. Otherwise, what could they do?
Yeah.
Only just wade in onto the sand.
Yeah.
So that was my first recollection of that, was seeing these platforms coming in. That was the landing I was involved in.
Yeah.
Just as in the background.
I don't know about the background. What was this flag that you were flying?
Oh no! If the flag was on it, if we had, if our tanks were behind us,
it was just for the tanks, was it?
For ours.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
They say, tell so and so to do this, and you would spell it out. You would go like this. That meant to say, I'm calling you.
And Frank's got his arms wide open.
And then they'd answer like this. That meant yes.
Yeah.
And then I remember that part. And then it was a case of do so and so.
Yeah.
Because there weren't radios from one tank to the next.
Right.
The only was the captain had the only one.
So you were the main communications man?
Well, yes, it came from shore or wherever. Even there might have been a big ship out there, a destroyer out there. And they were sending information to us to do something, do what my captain, and he told the rest of it.
I mean, it must have been chaos.
Well, it was, because nobody, you only knew what we were doing by these flags. The captain knew via radio, and he had to tell everybody what we were going to do. Somebody would say, there's a problem over there, go and get rid of the problem. And then they'd send a couple of these tanks to go and shoot them. There might have been some kind of a gun over there that was causing problems. But see, I don't really know. But that's what our instructions were. Do the little bits of things that were needed. We weren't there to go out and shoot people. We're out there just to help.
But if you haven't got the communications, the whole thing would just disintegrate.
Well, that's what it was. See, there were no way to communicate like there is now.
No.
But they didn't have any. They only knew what we told them by hand signals.
So you were the linchpin. I'm going to call you the linchpin.
We were the lynch for our crew, our section of the war.
Yeah.
We were looking after.
Well, Frank, you were 21.
I was 18 when I went in, and this was about 3 days
after. Three years after. Well, at the age of 21.
Yeah.
Being the linchpin.
Yeah.
In the D-Day landings.
Well, a linchpin in a little section.
A linchpin, an essential part of it. I don't think anybody could beat that. I think that's absolutely.
It was just a job that we had.
No.
Don't forget, we were Royal Marines, and they could do anything. Royal Marines.
Right, on that, it's
to brag about Royal Marines.
On that, it's goodbye from me, Christine, and goodbye from Frank.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
So are you going to say bye-bye to them?
Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.